Keep up with the guests and topics on What's the 411 with Sharon Kay. Friend us on Facebook and Twitter. Search under Sharon Kay's 411.
It's What's the 411. Here again, Sharon Kay.
All right, to Nashville. Sharon Kay is in the house. I should sing a song, but I don't sing. Nope, I don't. I could pretend, but, you know, I just save y'all, spare y'all the headache. Anyway, we have more information rolling in this afternoon like a freight train. Happy to have it's called community news coming in just a second, as well as our book of the day is Everyday Bias. Hal J. Ross will be back. Now, X, this is My Fair Share.
Charlene, I think.
Yes.
Hi, sweet. How you doing?
I'm doing okay. How are you?
I am well. What are you doing, girl? Shuffling around.
I'm trying to get this baby to get out of the toilet.
Oh, okay. Baby, get out of that toilet.
Like, you know, sorry.
Well, you want to get the baby out and then call me back.
Yeah, we good.
Okay. Because, I mean, you know, that's important.
Right.
Anyway, you are with My Fair Share, the co-creator. And how have you been? Was it last week I talked to you?
Yeah, I think it was.
Okay. Did you get some are people going on and taking the survey?
Yes, yes. We've had really great response rates so far. We're about, I think, almost like 2,000 responses. Ooh, wow. In the last week. So that's great.
Yeah,
can't complain. Yeah. But we need more people filling it out because okay. We know there's more than 2,000 folks in Nashville.
Oh,
so.
Yeah, definitely. And I know 2,000 of them call me up and say, Sharon Kay, I wish they'd such and such, and people would do thus and so. So, you know, that's your chance. Now, explain what the Equity Alliance is and this, how this My Fair Share survey came to be and the cooperative and the working with the mayor's office with this project.
Gotcha. So the Equity Alliance is a grassroots community organizing organization that focuses on Black voter engagement with a specific emphasis on racial equity. So we are here to make sure that we are fighting the systemic barriers that tend to oppress Black Americans. And so we believe that through using our voting power, we mm-hmm. can enact change through policy that will better our communities. So that's kind of how we operate, mm-hmm. Which is how we came to be with involving ourselves with the CARES Act federal money that the city has received. Mm-hmm. We know that Black Nashville and Latino community members have been really hurt by the coronavirus pandemic, mm-hmm. not only just economically, but from a public health standpoint, mm-hmm. too. Mm-hmm. So we're here to look out for Black folks, for lack of a better word. So we wanted to make sure that the monies get used in the right way from the city. And yeah. that's what we do. We hold our government accountable to what they're supposed to be doing.
All right.
So, yeah, you know, so we wanted to, we were asked by the mayor to say, hey, can you do this needs assessment in vulnerable populations and uh-huh. COVID hotspots to look at what are the real needs in the community and uh-huh. have they evolved over time? Do they think we're going to change over time now that, like, unemployment is running out? Mortgage and eviction moratoriums are starting to be lifted. Like, how do we respond to this pandemic mm-hmm. and really, really help people? So this data that we're collecting through the Our Fair Share survey mm-hmm. is going directly to the mayor and directly to Metro Council. Mm-hmm. So they're going to be deciding how the money gets spent. And we already know that it's already working. Just based off of last week, we presented some preliminary findings mm-hmm. from the survey, which found that a majority of respondents really want to see mortgage and rent relief for homeowners and renters. So the committee approved $10 million of the $55 million that they have left to spend. $10 million of it is going to be going towards mortgage and rent relief directly from the survey that we're conducting. Excellent. So this is how you get your fair share, and this is how you get your voice heard is through this survey, because we have that direct line to the mayor's office.
Wow. So how is that going to be distributed back to the people that have already said, where do they go line up and try to get that help before it's all gone?
Right. So right now, the United Way is the organization that they've designated as the entity that's going to hold the money. They haven't decided yet how it gets dispersed, but they will be working closely with us, the Equity Alliance, to make sure that the organizations that are doing the work actually get awarded the funds to distribute the money.
Okay, good. How long of a process you think this is? Because, rent is due for some people like yesterday, and, it's like emergency for people. So what can we expect?
Hopefully in the next week, if not sooner, we'll hear more information on how people can actually apply. So we know that yesterday through Metro Council, the money was approved, and now it's just sort of a logistical sort of red tape processes. We got to wait to see how United Way is going to be rolling that out.
Okay. But hopefully
in the next week or so, yes.
Yeah, they need to roll it soon. Sooner rather than later, because a lot of people did not get those because Congress is playing. And, it's just ridiculous. And, people are desperate. And, how dare the Republicans not take care of the citizens?
Right. Let's be awful. Real clear. U.S. Senate is playing. They will not, they think $600 of unemployment is just too much for folks.
Right.
So it's just ridiculous.
Yeah.
It really is.
It's terrible. Yeah. And people have to make those decisions between buying their children something to eat, or keeping their lights on, or paying their mortgage. It's like, what a choice. I mean, sit in the dark, go hungry, but here's my mortgage. I got a roof. I mean, those are real choices people are having to make. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And they shouldn't. Not in the, greatest country in the world, that is the richest country in the world. Absolutely. And we're sitting here arguing over $600 of unemployment.
It's shameful.
Republicans think that we're just gonna sit home and not get back to work. So it's just ridiculous.
It's a ridiculous argument. And I think the thought is, even we don't wanna, we'll take a loaf and everything they think that they can get, but y'all better not ask for no crumb. But it's our money. You are giving us back our own tax dollars, by the way.
Exactly.
This wasn't your money.
Right. This money has already been earned.
Absolutely. Well, I'm grateful for what you all are doing and the efforts of the mayor's office to make sure it is truly equitable and accountable to the citizens of this region. Because if not, I don't know. It's hard to tell, because there's stuff, coming out, Charlene, that, every single day. And I know for people that aren't in this business, it's got to be like machine gun fire, because stuff changes every 35 seconds. It just is a lot to consume and to keep up with. So, knowing that you all are grassroots working with a government entity, that's a relief. And also, your last week you all explained it where it was going to be like two phases, because you did a early push, and then when we started the push here last week, then it's like, is that like phase two or part two, or can you go over that part again?
Yes. So we did an initial push to get the word out there online, but now we're about to start going into the community and having people go door to door, go to different areas of town where people are frequenting to get people to sign up and do the survey. So tomorrow is Election Day, okay. August 6th. People are going to be going to the polls and standing in line. And our canvassers, our team is going to be out there, you know, encouraging people to take the survey while they're standing in line to go vote. So we'll be at two locations tomorrow. We'll be at the Bordeaux Library and the Madison Library in North Nashville to, you know, talk to voters. We'll be there from 3 o'clock mm-hmm. to 7:30 when polls close to make sure not only that people are taking a survey, but just have what they need to go vote as well. Mm-hmm. We publish a voter guide that we're going to be giving out as well. Mm-hmm. We'll have food. We'll have DJ. It's going to be a whole party at the polls. So it's going to be a great time.
Yeah.
And it's free. We'll be giving out gift cards to just encourage folks to take that survey. Just come see us at the Bordeaux Library mm-hmm. and Madison Library tomorrow if those are your locations to go vote.
Okay. Now, I have the survey pulled up because I have a link and the logo and everything on WFSKFM.org right there up front. And so you all can go on our site while you're listening online to us or whatever. And then you can take the survey, see, because which is what I just did. I just clicked from our site to your site and I'm on I'm on it now. Okay. And now have... it says, have you or your small business been impacted by COVID-19? And you have sections here for residents, take the survey, or for small businesses, take the survey. And they're not long. This doesn't take all night. It's very, very quick in nature, yep. and the questions are very precise. And, you know, so if, as far as time is concerned, it won't take you long to get this done. Of the results that you have received, you did mention what you overwhelmingly, the requests were. What was second place in that?
What was second place?
Yeah.
In terms of what people want the money to get spent on?
Yes.
I think the second thing was, it was, small business grants.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, people want to, you know, help out our minority small businesses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of our, you know, black and brown business owners got left out of the PPP money that the Small Business Administration was handing out because a lot of billion-dollar companies were able to go after it first, and some of the smaller organizations just weren't quick to the draw because it's first come, first serve.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we just aren't equipped sometimes to really have our paperwork in order to make sure that we are able to go after those government dollars. So the small business grants are really going to be helpful for people who really just got left behind in the initial round of funding.
Right. Mm-hmm. And would that be like some mom and pop style? Because I would think that, because I've seen a couple of places that haven't reopened or haven't opened and are unable because of the way they're made and uh-huh. served, they're closed, they're gone.
Right.
So
yeah, it's any small business, so it doesn't matter. But we're seeing that a lot of hospitality, retail, service industry type of, or restaurants and businesses have been the most impacted uh-huh. because they're relying a lot heavily on the workforce and, you know, hourly workers. But it could be any business that has been impacted and, you know, slowed down because of the economy. If you have lost business, lost revenue, if you your workers have gotten sick, any of that, you should fill out that survey.
Now, what if people got small, tiny government help, you know, uh-huh. early on, was able to get a little something? Is that they could take the survey, but they wouldn't expect to receive, or does that matter?
It doesn't matter if you've previously received assistance or not. Okay. That's actually one of the questions we ask on the survey is, have you received any financial support, whether nationally or locally? Mm-hmm. And so we want to know that information. The committee that's deciding on the money wants to know. They also want to know, like, how much cash do you have on hand to go forward and keep your business open? Mm-hmm. You know, how much longer can you stay open? So those are some insights that we need to know from you as a small business owner on how you've been impacted.
Okay, because I'm down to question number 9 already in this short time. Because the first 7, 8 are, you know, name, telephone number, and all that kind of stuff. Uh-huh. So down in number 9, it says, which of the following do you need to be able to stay at home safely and practice self-isolation or quarantine? And you cover quite a bit. Tell the audience, and I know you don't know everything off the top of your head, what are some of the things on here that people would be expecting to check?
So, you know, when the Safer at Home order was issued by the mayor earlier in March, you know, people were scrambling to just make sure that they could stay home. Right. So how have you been impacted because you had to quarantine? A lot of people are putting their church services were closed and they couldn't, you know, they didn't get access to religious services, virtual assistance and virtual learning, you know, things that because your child was at home and not in school, child care was an issue. That's an issue for me right now, you know, is I need someone to watch my babies because I'm still at work. I still have to work full time from home. Another thing is maybe you don't have access to the supplies and sanitary supplies to really keep your home safe and clean. Perhaps you don't have access to transportation or you didn't have transportation, you were taking the bus. Or if you were, I think we asked about, I forget what else we asked, but a lot of different ways. It could be, you know, perhaps someone in your home was sick and they had to quarantine. You know, how did that impact you as well? So we ask a variety of ways. It's not just if you had COVID or know someone that had COVID. Right. It's about all the different ways that you've been impacted. A lot of people are putting mental health. Their mental health has been, you know, affected by this pandemic. You know, people are seeing a therapist a lot more and they're stressed. You know, a lot of the demands of having to navigate all the uncertainties of what the pandemic is bringing. Right. You know, taking a toll on people's emotional mental health. So we want to know that as well. Yeah. So, those are the types of things that we need to know.
Excellent. Now, I'm telling you now, I'm down to question 12, see. I'm telling you, you can do this while you're flipping and flopping and you're spending time on Facebook.
Right. It literally takes like 6 minutes to take the survey.
Now, I'm on number 12. How many more do I have left?
I think there's 18 questions.
18. Now, see, I'm almost done in that short conversation. Yeah.
And some of those are just like yes, no questions, yeah, or it's like your name, your age, or, you know, all of that. But, you know, half the survey is just multiple choice and you're just clicking.
Yeah.
So you don't have to put a whole lot of thought and typing and, you know, into it.
And for somebody like me, I'm good. Praise the Lord. And so can I just say on here, like on 12, what I'd like to see the community have? Because it's like,
yes.
Okay, cool. Because Sharon Kay got you. Okay, I just clicked on it. I just clicked on it. I clicked on the economic support, rent, utilities, and food assistance for the community. So, boom, I got y'all. Okay, Charlene Oliver, thank you so much. And, you know, kiss the baby for me now here.
I sure will. He's over here playing with the remotes now.
Okay, he's gone on to the next thing. And I will be in touch with y'all soon to find out more. And, you know, thank you so much. I'll tell Tequila, I said I appreciate her And y'all,
yes,
you take good. Oh, give them the website. Give them the website.
Oh, yes. So go to ourfairsharenash.com. We're going to keep the survey open actually longer till August 30th. You have that to fill out. So the whole month of August, get that survey done. And the committee's going to make final recommendations to spend the money by September 10th. So we have until the end of August to let our voice be heard. Okay. Ourfairsharenash.com.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Charlene, and you have a good rest of the day, okay?
All right, you too. Thanks, Sharon.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And, you know, you can just go on the station website, which is where I'm taking it right now, and just click on their link on there. Boom, it's on the front page. You can't miss it. I'm saying. And then after you click on it, take the survey, look at our video. There's a video up there, you know, where we did a project with the Metro Health Department in the Frisk. And it was hot, wasn't it, Eggs? Oh, he's talking. He's in there on the phone. Anyway, all right, we're going to take a time out, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to What's the 411 with Sharon Kay.
What's the 411 with Sharon Kay is brought to you by Terry W. Jones, independent agent, State Farm Insurance. Life insurance is one of those subjects that makes people want to change the subject rather than admit they probably don't have enough. That's why State Farm agent Terry W. Jones focuses on how the benefits of life insurance actually live on by asking people to think in terms of life without having to sell the house, insurance, or life without having to give up college, insurance. Find out how the benefits of life insurance can live on for your family. Call State Farm agent Terry W. Jones in Nashville at 615-256-6066 or online at terrywjones.net and put the life back in life insurance.
Good afternoon. I'm looking at this crash. They're moving the car right now on 40 eastbound at Stewartsbury Pike. That slowed it down just a bit with a lot of rubbernecking going on in that part of town. That truck's still on its left side in Rutherford County. It's 24 eastbound at Walden Road. People are really rubbernecking as they drive by. That crash leaving Nashville headed to Murfreesboro. Murfreesboro Pike at Knight Valley Drive, that wreck with injuries. This traffic report brought to you by Princess Hot Chicken, 5814 Nolensville Pike. I'm Commander Chuck. You're on time traffic.
This message is sponsored by the Equity Alliance.
COVID-19 has ravaged black and brown communities. Our loved ones are disproportionately getting sick and dying at alarming rates. Thousands of workers are unemployed and small businesses are struggling to reopen.
Now, more than ever, we need our fair share of relief funding. I am Charlene Oliver.
And I am Tequila Johnson,
co-founders of the Equity Alliance.
Help us tell Nashville city leaders what you and your family need now to get through the pandemic. Go to ourfairsharenash.com today and take the survey.
On the next Jazz Night in America, John Batiste and the influence of jazz musicians on late night TV.
It's important to see that jazz is still a crucial part of the band that backs the most watched late night show on television, Stephen Colbert's show.
I think it's very special as a musician because these are environments that we're not usually a part of.
That's on the next Jazz Night in America. I'm Christian McBride.
Catch Jazz Night in America every Sunday from 2 to 3 p.m. and Wednesdays from 6 to 7 p.m. here at listener-supported Jazzy 88.
Keep up with the guests and topics on What's the 411 with Sharon Kay. Friend us on Facebook and Twitter. Search under Sharon Kay's 411.
It's What's the 411. Here again, Sharon Kay.
All right, to Nashville. Sharon Kay is in the house. Oh, yes. Mighty glad to be on Jazz Z88 WFSK Historic Fisker University. And thank you to the Equity Alliance for their time today. And take the survey, y'all. I'm almost done. I got just a couple more and boom, I'm finished. Now, this hour's book is Everyday Bias, Identifying and Navigating Unconscious Judgments by Our Daily Lives. And this is the updated edition. And I want to welcome back to the show Howard J. Ross. He is co-founder of is it Udarta? Is that correct, Howard? Okay, Udarta,
yes.
Consulting, and previously the founder of Cook Ross Incorporated. He is an internationally recognized expert on diversity, leadership, and organizational change, and is considered one of the world's leading authorities on unconscious bias. Well, I'm glad to have you back.
It's nice to be back with you, Sharon.
Oh, definitely. Now, where are you today?
I'm in Bethesda, Maryland, just outside of D.C.
Bethesda. Now, are you guys in staying in, are you under lock and key in your neighborhoods and all?
Well, we're all being careful, of course, as any sane person is right now. I think that, you know, we certainly can go out if we need to and get the things that we have to get. But the people in our community are being very, generally speaking, being very conscious of keeping each other safe. Mm-hmm. And people are wearing masks and, you know, very, very few people in this particular community are forcing their germs on other people.
Good for them. Very smart people. Yeah. Very smart. Or they're, as I say, keep your germs to yourself.
Exactly.
You know, I'm just saying. Now, that's good to hear. How have you adjusted your life? I see you had time to update your book.
Well, actually, you know, it's interesting, Sharon, because the original version of this book came out in August of 2014, about a month after Michael Brown was killed in Ferguson. Mm-hmm. And the publishers and I decided to update it over a year ago now. Mm. And so the work was actually written probably a good 6 months ago. And then, lo and behold, it comes out, you know, just shortly after George Floyd's murder. So it's ironic that the two bookending events, ended up corresponding with when the book's coming out, but it certainly is very applicable to what's going on in our culture right now.
Oh, no question. Because I think I had you on, it may have been a year or two ago. You've been on a couple of times with me to talk about this topic, and I'm just tickled to death to have you back to talk about it again, because you have put the work in and are recognized as being someone who's been working on issues like this for a long time. And you come at this, you know, a lot of times, and I say this and I mean it, I'm not playing everybody, black people are expected to do all the work. You know, we did, it's all, you know, we were the victims, but we're supposed to fix it. That's like not fair, okay? So I'm glad to get your input today, because it's not fair that we have to be the only ones speaking up. You know, white America is like wants to take no responsibility for anything, and that's not fair. I mean, it's not right, and I know life is not fair, but at least you are working to help people get out of that mindset. And you've been doing this for decades, Howard. I know that.
Yeah, I started doing this professionally in the mid '80s, Sharon. But really, my career in social justice started when I was a teenager. You know, back in the 1960s, I got involved with civil rights and then the anti-war movement, and then did a lot of work with the Farm Workers Union during the early Great Boycott. But I think we're all to a certain degree products of our history. And in my case, it was my family is Jewish, and we came from Eastern Europe, and we had enormous loss during the Holocaust. In fact, 42 members of my family were killed on August 2nd and 3rd, 1942, when the Nazis killed all but 100 of the 5,000 people who lived in the community that my grandfather grew up in the Western Ukraine. Yeah. And so, you know, that pain in our background that drove both my sisters and I to get involved in social change work. And so my older sister became one of our nation's leading immigration lawyers. My younger sister worked with Marion Wright Edelman at the Children's Defense Fund for many years. And my path was initially as an educator, and then I started doing this work, as I said, about 35 years ago, and just just haven't looked back. Now, I think one of the challenges is that we sometimes see this as the work of people who've been victimized by oppression, whether mm-hmm. it's seeing people of color doing work on race, or women doing work on gender, or LGBTQ people doing mm-hmm. work on sexual orientation. But the truth is, we all have a stake in the society we live in. And I think one of the things that's really heartening about the social justice movement that we see occurring right now, particularly the racial justice movement, is mm-hmm. how diverse it really is. You know, how many young white folks are out in the streets along with their brothers and sisters of color to take on this issue. And I think that's really encouraging for our future.
Well, and since the George Floyd lynching by knee, mm-hmm. do you see that as being a such a tipping point that it emotionally touched people, you know, globally? Not just it was that black dude dead on the ground, but that, you know, the depravity of the whole thing. Does that make sense? Do you see something different this time?
Well, I think that there are a number of things. You know, I mean, timing is everything. And and I think that there's not only, I think, like you said, that this particular incident was so abhorrent. I think I saw Ava DuVernay interviewed, mm-hmm. and she was saying, you know, she was looking at why this struck her so much more deeply than all the films she saw when she was doing Selma or when she was doing 13th. And she said something that really struck me, which was there's rarely been a case where we could see the face of the perpetrator in such a prolonged way. And you sat and looked at Derek Chauvin's face during this murder, and it was almost, the lack of affect was so chilling. It was almost like you could, the guy's facial expression looked like he could have been saying, hey, get me a beer while I'm killing
exactly,
this guy.
Exactly.
I think that was a piece of it, but I think there's another piece of it too. I think we've been undergoing, you know, this tremendous, I think during the Trump administration, this tremendous rise of white nationalism and, mm-hmm. and white supremacy coming out of the closets. It's not like any of us who do the work thought that was gone anyway, mm-hmm. but now it's been invited back into the open by the president. I think you've got the tension that's been created by COVID and all of us being locked up for all this time and mm-hmm. all the fear and apprehension we have. And then you've also got the fact of, you know, the impact of COVID on communities of color, particularly the black community, the Latinx community, and the Native Indigenous communities, in addition to the Asian communities that have been suffering from more bullying and hate crimes mm-hmm. as a result of the racialization of the disease. And so I think because of all of those reasons, this particular incident, you know, there was just, there's a lot of hay for that match to catch fire to.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing is that I know from, I work all over the world, you know, I have contacts all over the world, and I've mm-hmm. worked in 45 other countries. And what my friends and colleagues in other places are telling me is that people have lost respect for the United States during the Trump administration. And I think that they're particularly reactive to what we're doing because they have so much judgment about us mm-hmm. for electing somebody with such clearly racist attitudes.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And people proud of it, you know, and I'm like, man, that's deep. And okay with it. That's the thing. They don't think anything is wrong with this, you know, behavior. It's, in their eyes, it's perfectly normal to hate everybody and everything. I don't get it. I mean, help me, because I know this is what you do.
Well, I think that we do need to separate different classifications of people, because it's so easy to throw people into one big bucket. I think you certainly have a certain kind of, we might call, lunatic fringe who are out there, the David Dukes and the Richard Spencers of the world, who are just haters and herders, and those people have almost hooked their identity to the fact that they are racist. But I don't think that's the larger percentage of people. But I do think that there are a large percentage of people who see the world changing in front of them. Mm-hmm. They feel the power and influence they've had all their life, the power of white privilege, being confronted by these changing demographics in our society mm-hmm. and the larger numbers of people of color, black, indigenous people of color. And I think there are a lot of people who see this power hold slipping away in very unconscious ways. It's scary, and people are frightened what the future will look like, and they don't know quite how to deal with it. And so And then it's fed by, I think also another big factor is the division in the news that we get. So if you're watching Fox News or you're reading conservative outlets, you know, instead of seeing protesters, you're told that they're rioters. And, you know, instead of seeing Black Lives Matter as a movement to create equity and justice for people, you're told that Black Lives Matter is a black nationalist movement where people who think that black people are the only ones who should be concerned about. And so I think the combination of misinformation and fear is a dangerous cocktail that creates the kind of reaction we're seeing.
Absolutely. Now, in your beginning, in your introduction, Blinded by the Light of Our Bias, you write, did you know people in supermarkets buy more French wine when French music is playing in the background, and more German wine when the music is German, that white National Basketball Association NBA referees have been found to call more fouls on black players, and black referees call more fouls on white players? that actually is interesting. Now, knowing that's where you're starting, when you see this phenomenon, I guess they call her Becky or Karen or the Karens, and, you know, the white women screaming and, you know, carrying on when they see somebody of color, let me call the police, and that type of thing. Is that what happens? That, you know, I see you as, that's my bias, I see you, and I'm automatically going to think criminal?
Well, I think that, again, we're seen through a particular lens. You know, I mean, I don't need to tell you. We have a history of 350 years of legalized diminishing of people of color versus white people in this country between, you know, between legalized slavery, and then even after emancipation, another 250 years of legalized slavery, and then another 100 years after that of legal separation and segregation. And so that's 17 generations, 17 generations in this country that have trained all people of color and white folks to play a particular role in this society, what Brian Stevenson refers to as the narrative of racial difference. And so what that leads to is people being treated differently in fundamental ways, but we just sort of accept it. So Khalif Broder, you know, this young brother is wrongly accused of stealing a backpack. He's thrown in jail for 3 years at Rikers Island at 16 years old, two of those years in solitary confinement. He kills himself after being abused. Roger Stone is convicted of witness tampering and obstruction of justice, sentenced to 3 years, and doesn't serve a day in prison. Right. Tanya McDonald is a homeless mother who lied about getting a school district. She wanted to get her six-year-old into a better school. She's sentenced to 5 years in jail, but Felicity Huffman, the actress, pays $15,000 to cheat on her daughter's college application, and she gets 14 days in jail. Right. So, and I could go on and on, these comparisons that are so obviously, Colin Kaepernick, you know, is called an SOB and a traitor by the president for taking a knee, and yet these guys who storm the Michigan State House with automatic weapons are called patriots. Exactly. So, I mean, at some point, it's irrational.
Yeah. And so America is suffering from irrational behavior, or is this the culmination of the 17 generations and how it's manifest? Because somebody lit the flame, somebody struck the match on it, ignited it into complete craziness like what we have in the White House.
Yeah. Well, I think there's no question that that President Trump, and no question in my mind, I should say, that President Trump is both a cause and effect. He's the effect of the frustration that people felt. He tapped into a feeling that was already there, but then he's obviously thrown gasoline on the fire. But I think that the bigger issue is this, and that is that my experience of working with thousands and thousands of people over the years about this has been that very few people wake up in the morning and wring their hands and say, "How can I suppress people of color today?" You know, that's not the way it happens. It's just that we're raised in a culture in which our education system teaches us certain things, our religious system teaches us certain things, family stories, the things that we observe teach us that this narrative of racial difference exists. And so it's natural then to not only to allow, but to put in place systems and structures that provide sort of unconscious benefits to people who are in the upper part of that system, white people, and systems and structures that make it a little bit more difficult, or sometimes a lot more difficult, for the lower people in that system. And so things like housing loans and voter rights restrictions and access to healthcare, food and services, policing structures, you know, all of these things support that system. And then those things that we put in place then create a disparate impact. So you've got, you know, white people are more successful than people of color because of all these systems. Sure. And then we look at that disparate impact. Some people look at that disparate impact and say, you see, I told you, they are better. We are better than them. And so it's a cycle that we get trained in. Yeah. And most people, in my experience, embrace this stuff without even realizing that they're embracing it.
Absolutely. That is correct, Armando. Howard J. Ross is his name. And he has been with us before. It's been a few years. Well-known, internationally recognized expert on diversity, leadership, and organizational change. And this is an empowerment show, and this is a subject that I tackle regularly, and it is about bias. So turn the radio up. Let's take a time out, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to What's the 411 with Sharon Kay.
What's the 411 with Sharon Kay is brought to you by Terry W. Jones, independent agent, State Farm Insurance. Life insurance is one of those subjects that makes people want to change the subject rather than admit they probably don't have enough. That's why State Farm agent Terry W. Jones focuses on how the benefits of life insurance actually live on by asking people to think in terms of life without having to sell the house, insurance, or life without having to give up college, insurance. Find out how the benefits of life insurance can live on for your family. Call State Farm agent Terry W. Jones in Nashville at 615-256-6066 or online at terrywjones.net and put the life back in life insurance.
Good afternoon. We're still looking live at this truck crash. It's laying on its left side out here in Rutherford County. It's 24 eastbound at Walden Road. You're able to get by the accident, but boy, people are rubbernecking big time as we look at it live here on 24 eastbound at Walden Road, just inside Rutherford County as you leave Nashville headed out towards Murfreesboro. This traffic report brought to you by Bars Music City Soul Food. BarsMusicCitySoulFood.com. I'm Commander Chuck. You're on time traffic.
It's What's the 411 with Sharon Kay.
Hello, Nashville. Coming up Sunday morning at 7, news headlines and issues of the day. Then at 8 o'clock, the discussion is on finding a deeper fellowship with God in spaces of loneliness. My guest is Jason Gavery. He's a regional ministry director with the InterVarsity Christian Fellowship.
That's What's the 411 with Sharon Kay, twice a week, every Sunday morning from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. and every Wednesday afternoon from 4 to 6 p.m. right here on Jazzy 88 WFSK.
This message is sponsored by the Equity Alliance.
COVID-19 has ravaged Black and brown communities. Our loved ones are disproportionately getting sick and dying at alarming rates. Thousands of workers are unemployed and small businesses are struggling to reopen.
Now, more than ever, we need our fair share of relief funding. I am Charlaine Oliver.
And I am Tequila Johnson,
co-founders of the Equity Alliance.
Help us tell Nashville city leaders what you and your family need now to get through the pandemic. Go to OurFairShareNash.com today and take the survey.
Keep up with the guests and topics on What's the 411 with Sharon Kay. Friend us on Facebook and Twitter. Search under Sharon Kay's 411.
It's What's the 411. Here again, Sharon Kay.
All right, in Nashville. Sharon Kay is in the house, and Wednesday afternoon, take you home edition, and happy to be in the seat and doing the things, you know, that we get to do. We're tickled to death to be able to work the gifts, you know. Now, this book was recently updated and a little bit of expansion on it. Originally done in 2014, Everyday Bias, Identifying and Navigating Unconscious Judgments in Our Daily Lives. And Howard J. Ross is the author, and he also is a returning guest to the show. And decades of work on diversity and on issues of bias and unconscious judgments, etc. So we're happy to have him circle back through. And a couple of things, and before I go into one of the chapters, I do want to mention that, Howard, you, when you wrote the book in 2014, you probably had a lot of people who did or didn't want to believe, you know, oh, he don't, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, because you give a lot of good scenarios. When did the updated version get sent out? Just this year or
last? Just last week. It just was released last week. Yeah.
Oh, Lord. Yeah. Okay, that's like totally fresh.
Yeah.
Okay. And also, as I remember it, that you taught at HBCU before, right?
Yeah, I was a professor of diversity in residence at Bennett College for Women back in 2006-2007 when Julianne Malveaux was the president of the college.
Yes.
And it was a wonderful experience. Dr. Malveaux has been a longtime friend and colleague of mine, and Dr. Janetta Cole, who was the previous president, is also a dear friend and like family to me. So I was able to come down there, and it was really a... it was an extraordinary experience. You know, I went down there as this old white guy coming down to teach these young black women about diversity, and frankly, I expected them to throw me out of the place. But we ended up forming an unbelievable relationship. In fact, there are probably six or seven of my students from that time who I still, all these years later, still are in contact with, and you know, mentor them and support them in whatever way I can. And it was really, really a remarkable experience. I think, you know, one of the things about it, Sharon, that I feel so fortunate about is that when you're white in this society, usually when people get together in mixed groups, they tend to lean towards white culture because that's our, quote, you know, normative culture.
Yeah.
And so being the only white guy on a campus of 600 black women plus faculty members, it gives me a window into culture in a way that I couldn't get it any other way, and just a really wonderful and remarkable experience.
Well, I am so glad, because that certainly opened your eyes to so much, and gave you an opportunity to not just say, as some folks do, I don't really know any black people, though. I'm like, okay, but you are doing this kind of work. What you mean? and there you really got the true experience being at an HBCU, man, for real. And how is Miss Malveaux? Is she doing okay?
Yeah, she's great. I just spoke to her the other day, as a matter of fact. She's out there, you know, raising hell like she always does. I absolutely love her. She's one of the smartest people I've ever known, first of all, and one of the boldest, and really somebody who's been willing to speak truth to power throughout her whole life. And I've known her now for more than 20 years, and I admire her tremendously.
Definitely. She's been on the show a couple of times over the years. And all I had to do was just sit back and go on, and, you know, because she did, you know, she carried. I didn't have to. I just asked her one question, and if she was off, maybe she was off to the races, okay?
Exactly.
That's all I know. I'm like, man, I can just sit back in the chair today, for real. Now, Howard, I forgot to mention before the break, I wanted to talk about chapter 4 and really kind of go into the book there, because chapter 4 is life, death, arrest, and unconscious bias. And then we see that all just playing out in places like Aurora, Colorado, and, you know, just yesterday or day before, and all that stuff that went down and those children throwed them in the handcuffed them on the parking lot and the whole shebang. So talk about this chapter, and I know you've got some 2018 incidents in here. Tell us what it's about.
Well, I think that, you know, when you wrote the original book in 2014, the Trayvon Martin incident had just happened. And so we had a whole chapter devoted to Trayvon Martin and what happened in that particular case. But when it came time to update it, we realized that, you know, so many other things had happened. You know, the Starbucks incident that occurred, Michael Brown being shot in Ferguson, which actually had happened just before the book was published in 2014, but wasn't in the book. Freddie Gray, Sam DeBoos, Terrence Crutcher, you know, Jamar Clark, Tamir Rice. I mean, I could go on. Sadly, Sandra Bland. You know, I could go on and on with these names. This sad list of names that we've experienced all too often. And the reality is that I think there's something very fundamental that we have to understand in looking at this, and that there's a very different way that generically white people, and I want to be really clear when I talk about groups, whether it's white or black or Latinx or whatever, I'm not using a stereotype here. I'm talking about the archetype, the general patterns of those groups. That white folks, you know, there are a lot of caring white folks out there who look at these things and they think they're terrible, but mostly the tendency is to see them as a series of incidents. You know, here's another terrible incident that happened, and when are these terrible incidents going to stop? The last one being George Floyd being another one, sadly, not the last one, because we had Rashard Brooks after that, and like you said, they keep happening week by week. But I think that's very different than the experience that African Americans have, and it's important to understand this difference, because if we see them as a series of incidents, that we can buy into this notion that they're sort of bad apples. So Derek Chauvin, the guy who killed George Floyd, is a bad apple, and the last one was a bad apple. But the African-American experience, as you know better than I do, is not a series of incidents. It's a day-by-day, everyday experience that these incidents just pop it up to the surface for people to see. You know, I can give you an example of what I'm talking about, and like I said, I know you have even more than I would ever even think about. I had a client here in Washington, D.C., who's a corporate client, a senior guy, made more than $500 million a year, and lived in a very high-income, mostly white suburban community. And he told me one day in tears in his office that his son had been home the summer before from the Ivy League college where he was going. I think it was Princeton or something like that. And in the 10 weeks that his son was home, he was stopped four times by police officers coming in and out of his own neighborhood driving his father's car. They're never charged with anything because his only crime was being a young black man driving an expensive car in a predominantly white neighborhood. But the father said to me, like I said, in tears, he said to me, the thing that terrified me the most was that my son would eventually lose his temper. And that something terrible would happen. And I think that's the thing that most people don't understand. That for every George Floyd, there are 100 cases like that where it may not have risen to the level of being filmed. It may not have risen to the level of somebody being killed. But maybe they were just pushed around. They were abused. They were harassed. They were stopped unnecessarily. They were laid out on the ground when they didn't need to be, or things like that. And I think that's one of the fundamental ways that white and black people see these things differently.
Yeah, most definitely. And, you know, and that is with the law enforcement as well as with the citizens. I can remember back in, this has probably been twice major that it started just working my nerves, and one of them was this year. I've been living in the same house for a long time. I'm paying a mortgage. I'm a regular person, okay? I cut, you know, the grass and the bushes, you know. I'm one of those kind of people. So I noticed that my neighbors would, you know, all of a sudden started watching me like, who is she? And you see me every year. I mean, you know, I don't look any different. Like, are you sure that's your house? I mean, it was such a difference back in April, May and June. And it was just such a, and this would have been around the time when folks were quarantined and all, and starting to notice everything, every move that anybody made. And I'm like, I've been living here probably longer than most of y'all. So, you know, and my neighborhood is largely white. There's a couple of black families, but, you know, we pay car notes, okay? We vote, okay? So, I mean, they were just, it was this look. This is just white America's, the look. And, you know, not just the police.
Well, it's more than a look, though, because that look leads to suspicion.
It does.
That feeling difference. You know, I put together recently for a program that I was delivering, I did some research and looked over the last, you know, 6-7 years, some examples of reasons why white people had called the police on blacks. And the list is staggering. I mean, just a few of them, sitting at Starbucks is one, of course, selling water, eating lunch, opening their own business, waiting for an Uber, playing golf too slow, putting their feet up in class, napping, entering their own apartment, mowing grass, attempting to crash a check, using the wrong type of barbecue, listening to a yoga CD, attempting to use a cue. I mean, I could go on and on because they're, these are absurd, babysitting children, right. You know, bumping into somebody in a deli, you know, using a swimming pool, whatever, being accused of being agitated, you know, all of these reasons that are called living, and yet living while black is more dangerous than living while white.
Well, the one that really was so ridiculous was the black bird watcher. Okay.
Yes,
that,
exactly.
That one was like, oh my God.
Central Park Amy, yes.
Yeah, oh, Lord. I'm just like, oh, this is serious.
There's an interesting thing about Central Park Amy that I think it's important for us to realize, because it actually shows how deeply embedded these unconscious patterns are. Because here you had a woman who was, by every account I've read, a liberal, supported big Clinton supporter, you know, all that kind of stuff. And yet, when pushed to her automatic reaction, her visceral reaction, immediately weaponized Mr. Cooper's blackness. You know, that was the immediate first thought that came to her mind. I'm going to call them and tell them I'm being attacked by a black man, or I'm being harassed by a black man, because in underneath all of that stuff, the visceral part of us is still there. And this is the thing that I think that's so hard for some of us who are white to get, which is how deeply embedded racism is in us, even though we don't want to look. I've had my own experiences of having this thought or feeling come up, and I'm like, look at myself and say, where did that come from? You know, it's so much a part of our socialization that it's almost impossible for us to escape it. And some of it gets internalized, as you know, among black folks as well. Black folks, they have similar judgments about other black folks.
Absolutely. And that to me, you know, that doesn't even make an ounce of sense. Why are you complaining about this and that, and you're doing the same thing? But that's some of our own work, our own biases that we need
to work on.
So this is not just a one-way street, y'all. This street goes both ways. And you know something that, because we're just about out of time.
That's a shame.
I know, but you know, I'm going to fix that, okay? you know, I already told you during the break how I'm going to fix it. When we come back, Howard, next time I'm going to swing you back in the schedule shortly, soon.
Good.
And because you know me and you, we got lots to say. I want you to start. I want to go to chapter 6, and let that be the entry point for our next conversation. And you know, as the last time, I should have kept you longer, and I was like, and now I know. Anyway, but we're out of time today. Now, if people want to get the updated version of Everyday Bias, which was a very top seller book, where is it? Everywhere. You said it just came out yesterday.
It came out last Thursday. You know, they go to Amazon or Barnes and Noble, any of those online booksellers. Yeah. If anybody wants to contact me directly, they can either go to howardjross.com or Udarta, UDARTA.com, and I'm reachable at both of those places.
What's Udarta?
Udarta is a little company we created. You know, I had a company that I ran for 30 years, Cook Ross, which I still love and still sometimes do some work with, but we sold that company to our partner about 2 years ago, just because, you know, getting to that stage in life where we wanted a little bit more flexibility. So we created, my wife and I, who are business partners, created Udarta, because I said when I sold the company that I was rewiring, not retiring, and there's still a lot of fight in me. So this is just, it's just a little company that we created. We're not growing it, but we're just use it to do our work from.
Yeah, good. So. Hey, I liked it. Can I borrow that when you're not retiring? You're rewiring. Okay.
You go for that.
I'm going to give you credit for it because I like that one. That works.
All right. Fair enough.
Howard, thank you so much, man. I appreciate you more than I can say. And we'll I'll be in touch real, real soon, okay?
Thanks, Sharon. It's good to hear you, sister. And you stay safe and be well. Oh,
most definitely. All right. Bye-bye. That's Howard J. Ross and... you know, I just love him. He's just down to earth and everything. And everyday bias, it's been updated, identifying and navigating unconscious judgments in our daily lives. And I just want to remind the audience that we didn't just start talking about this subject on this show when this stuff happened earlier this year in this country. This show has been on the air for almost 20 years. And the entire time, I'm black, and I've been talking about this. So I don't want to hear this. People in the media, I'm in it. I'm doing it. So that's all we have for you, Nashville. You all have the very best of the best. And don't forget who loves you.
You've been listening to What's the 411 with Sharon Kay. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station and its management.
You're listening to What's the 411 with Sharon Kay.